Hey there, and welcome back to another episode of Lost Origins, your number one radio show for all things ancient mystery, alternative historical theory, and lost civilizations. I'm your host, Andrew, and I want every single one of you to hop online, head over to lost-origins.com, make your way around the site, sign up for that free newsletter, and interact with us online. We love talking to you guys. We love hearing about who you want to have on the show, what topics you want our writers to cover with respect to the articles, and just hearing from you guys in general. You guys can also connect with us on social media. We are on almost every single platform, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, Stitcher, iTunes, and Google Play. So hit that subscribe button, you guys, and never miss an episode or an article from your friends here at Lost Origins. This week's episode of Lost Origins is brought to you by our very good friends over at Inner Traditions and Baron Company. Inner Traditions and Baron Company, they have been publishing books on esoteric philosophy, New Age spirituality, alternative health, and ancient mysteries for well over 40 years. You guys should go check out their website at innertraditions.com, sign up for their newsletter, coupons, catalogs, special offers. Make your way around their site, get to know their authors, and check out some of their books. You guys will not be disappointed. We have absolutely loved working with our friends at Inner Traditions and Baron Company, and every single book that we've read that has come out of that publishing house has just been an incredible experience. So head over to their website, check it out. More specifically, take a look at some of the work by Christopher Dunn, because that is exactly who we're going to be talking to today on Lost Origins. This week's episode is going to be just incredibly fascinating and mind-blowing. I've been a longtime fan of the work of Christopher Dunn, and one of my first introductions to him and his work was through an episode of Ancient Aliens that I watched several years ago, and I was just hooked. I know that his work goes back much further than his appearance on Ancient Aliens, but that was one of my first times being introduced to him and his theories, and his work is fascinating. He's been a manufacturing engineer, and he has over 50 years of experience, so he's definitely an expert in his field. He's worked primarily in aerospace with an emphasis on precision and laser application, which is just awesome. And he has published dozens of articles on his theories around ancient technology. And he's also the author of the well-known book, The Giza Power Plant, and more recently, The Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt. So today we are so pleased to bring him onto the show. We're going to be discussing his theories surrounding the Giza pyramids, the incredible technologies of ancient Egypt, and Egypt's connection to Nikola Tesla right after the break. Hey there, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to this week's episode of Lost Origins. If you're just tuning in, I'm your host, Andrew, and this week's episode focuses on one of my all-time favorite theories. I first became introduced to the work of Christopher Dunn several years ago while I was watching an episode of Ancient Aliens. And I know his work goes back much further than that, but that was one of my first true introductions or experiences with respect to learning about his work. And ever since then, I've been absolutely hooked. Christopher Dunn is a manufacturing engineer, and he has over 50 years of experience in that field. So he's definitely an expert in that, right? And his work primarily focuses on aerospace with an emphasis on precision and laser application, which, if you ask me, just sounds awesome. He's authored several books, including The Giza Power Plant and Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt. I've been looking forward to this conversation for a long time, so it is my pleasure to welcome Christopher Dunn to this week's episode of Lost Origins. Chris, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Andrew. Thank you for inviting me.
No, the pleasure is all ours. You know, like I said, I've been following your work for a long time. I know that your work goes back. Your first book came out, I believe, in 1998.
Yes.
But my first true introduction to your work was Ancient Aliens, which, you know, I know there's a lot of theories that are presented on that show that some people may agree or disagree with, but I think it definitely serves as a great sounding board for a lot of researchers to get their theories out there. I mean, we've also talked with Giorgio Tsoukalos and Robert Bovall and several people that have been on the show that aren't necessarily discussing aliens, but they're definitely using that show as a sounding board to reach a broader audience to expose their theories. So definitely an awesome experience. That's how I was introduced to your work. But before we dig into your work, Chris, I always like to give our first-time guests the floor to talk about their background. So with you working as a manufacturing engineer, I'd like to learn more about your line of work, how that lends itself to your theories, and then maybe explain a little bit about what prompted you to apply your trade directly to ancient Egypt, because Illinois and Egypt are not exactly within close proximity to one another. So I'd like to learn your story.
Well, I actually started out in Manchester, England.
Okay.
And I entered manufacturing at the tender age of 15 years old and took an apprenticeship. And so that apprenticeship led me to the age of 23, where I emigrated to the USA, and I worked in aerospace in the USA until I retired a couple of years ago. But along the way, it has brought me along a path of research that seemed to dovetail in very nicely and closely with my line of work when applying it to the study of Egyptian monuments.
Okay.
And it seemed like that they just resonated with me. But as far as the manufacturing part of it goes, that that brought me a great interest in technology, how technology works, because you know we're involved in creating artifacts that that serve the production of different technologies, such as aircraft and aerospace manufacturing and things of that nature. But definitely the epitome of the technology. But the how technology works, and then I was interested in also the production of energy. So there was a lot of, kind of side interests that I had. And one of them came into my hand via the book by Peter Tompkins, Secrets of the Great Pyramid. But I became very interested in ultimate history back in the 60s when there was a book called Morning of the Magicians by Powers and Bergier. And I read that book and I was fascinated by an alternate view of history, and then von Daniken came along with his Chariots of the Gods.
Sure.
And that became a huge hit. So I was very interested in that. And that led me to Tompkins' book, Secrets of the Great Pyramid, because it seemed that if you're discussing alternate history, the Great Pyramid looms very large in the background. And it seems to be a perennial enigma where it's never satisfied in terms of anybody that attempts to try to explain it, and the numerous theories that existed, countless theories that existed, that still seem to fall short in explaining what it truly means. And so it was actually the study of that book, and then the realization that the Great Pyramid was more than what I had been taught in school. The Tompkins book really opened the door to questioning the official academic theories for the Great Pyramid, in terms of, is the tomb theory really correct? What evidence do we have to support it? And if it's not a tomb, then what is it?
Right.
And so that seemed to be the prevailing question that kind of threads through all of these discussions. If not a tomb, then what is it?
Right.
And so I was studying the book one night, and I was kind of I was working through a chapter where he was discussing Sir Winders Flinders Petrie, William Flinders Petrie, who was the first Egyptologist who performed research in Egypt in the 1880s. And Petrie's studies of the Great Pyramid astounded me in terms of the precision of the structure. And then looking at the drawings, the cross-section of the Great Pyramid and how it was laid out, it seemed to me that it had the appearance of a machine more than it did a building for human habitation or even to be a tomb. I mean, it just didn't make sense if you looked at it as a tomb or a temple or, you know, anything that where humans would have access to it at any time. And so I began to look at it as more of a machine. And there are some fairly, I mean, there's good reason to do that because of the precision with which the Great Pyramid was made. And the construction of it and the precision of the blocks and the sort of passageways and how the blocks are fitted together, you know, you could can't even fit a piece of paper between them. And there is a high order of precision, so that if you actually scaled it down to what we would consider to be, you know, a reasonable sized machine, it would be an extraordinarily precise machine.
Right.
And so that's when the kind of the light bulb went off in above my head, and the question then became, well, if it was a machine, how did it function?
Right.
And then, you know, the kind of it's kind of like, what was your state of mind? Yes, if you ask the question, what was your state of mind that caused you to actually come up with a particular theory or suggestion or idea, a proposal? And my state of mind was that here we had, in ancient times, what would be considered to be the state of the art of their building, engineering, manufacturing capabilities. I mean, if we were to construct it even today, it would be considered a state of the art building.
Right.
That's how amazing the structure is. And so, and then the question after that is, if they would devote that much of their resources into the construction of this building, then what were they expecting out of it? You know, how do they justify the investment? What was the return on their investment?
Sure.
And understanding too that ancient people have constructed beautiful buildings for, you know, temples and invested enormous resources into the construction of temples and palaces and things of that nature, that, you know, it's not beyond our psyche to build a gorgeous tomb, a very magnificent tomb, just for a dead revered leader.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, you look at the Taj Mahal in India, and you know, you have these numerous places around the planet where these revered leaders are buried. But the Great Pyramid had a different quality to it and also a different appearance to it, and certainly the investment of resources had to have been probably the greatest that you would could imagine.
Uh-huh.
in any period of time. I mean, even in our period of time, the amount of resources that it would take up, I don't think anybody has really put a good number on it yet.
Sure.
I mean, even the quarrying of the limestone, a sufficient amount of limestone to build the Great Pyramid would take 27 years in modern times. So that's how significant a work it is.
Well, and it's always mind-boggling to wrap your head around, you know, figures like that or how much work actually went into that, yet we're attributing all of that to slave labor and to people that were working with a very limited array of tools, supposedly. There's a lot of inconsistencies.
Yes.
That don't add up, you know?
Yeah, yes, you're right. And the thing is that the building doesn't really reflect primitive labor or slave labor or primitive labor. It doesn't reflect that kind of quality in the workforce.
Right.
That doesn't mean that we have different classes of worker today. We have the very highly skilled and then the semi-skilled and unskilled workers that work on projects, but none of them are what we consider to be slave laborers. Yes, they have been in the past, and there may be some parts of the world today where some might consider people to be enslaved in their work. But it's really hard to be able to put your finger on what the how the workforce actually was made up back then, and even how many people were engaged in the building of it.
Right.
Because you're right, there is no evidence, there are no tools to explain how they were built. Uh-huh. There are no tools to explain the many different objects that we find, not just in Egypt, but all over the world, that reflect an enormous degree of sophistication and precision of production. And it's not just the precision and the sophisticated geometries that we find in places around the world, but also the size of the blocks we don't select the huge 200 ton, 500 ton blocks to build with. We cut them into smaller elements, mm-hmm. and, stack them together. But it seemed like in the further back in time you go, the more amazing and the more the weight of the blocks that they were using. So there's many different mysteries that demand explanation. But the one mystery of the Great Pyramid, I tried to determine just from the evidence within the Great Pyramid how it may have functioned as a machine. And so we get into the different features within the Great Pyramid and trying to find an explanation for everything. And that was what the Giza power plant attempted to do. Was working with the data set that we have and the dimensions, observations from explorers going back into the 1600s, 1700s, and what they had noted when they were there, and finding explanations for just about everything. And then some of the more modern explorers, such as Ganton Brink and his exploration of the Queen's Chamber Southern Shaft,
uh-huh.
all seem to fit into this this theory of the Great Pyramid being a machine which produced energy.
And I think that's a great place for us to start discussing that theory specifically. I mean, your book from 1998, The Giza Power Plant, I mean, the theories that you're talking about in that book are just, they're mind-boggling, especially for somebody that, doesn't really doesn't look at these pyramids or these ancient structures as a machine or something of technological origin, right? A lot of people attribute these monuments to that of a tomb, which, you and I both know there is no evidence within those pyramids that says this is a tomb. And what evidence we do have is incredibly speculative. So for our listeners that maybe are not very familiar with your theory of the Giza pyramids having served as a power plant, maybe give us a brief overview of that theory, right? What do you believe the pyramids were used for? What purpose did they serve? And I think that's going to kind of steer the rest of our conversation today.
Yes, I think if we get to the actual root of the technology, just the basis of it, the pyramids, and I'm talking about all the pyramids now, not just the Great Pyramid, I believe functioned as coupled oscillators. in that they responded to the Earth frequencies and were actually used to reduce the forces that were building up within the planet. So if you have a tectonic plate where you are building up forces between the boundaries of the tectonic plate, where you have a subduction zone and you have stresses building up in that area,
okay,
that eventually would release destructively as an earthquake, then perhaps by drawing off that energy over time rather than allowing it to build up to a destructive level, then you could avoid an earthquake or, you know, a severe magnitude earthquake, and thereby saving lives and property. So that kind of basis, I think, works for all the pyramids, and they all kind of seem to lend to that idea in that they do have specific frequencies, and those frequencies are beginning to be mapped and determined to actually be in harmony with the frequencies of the Earth and also of other bodies in the universe, such as, I would say, the Great Pyramid in the King's Chamber. It has a resonant frequencies of that form an F-sharp chord. And this was detected by Thomas Danley, who was an acoustic engineer, in 1995. And then, but the F-sharp chord, which would contain a C-sharp, the C-sharp is the frequency of the quasar, the pulsar, Vela X. And so you have, you know, some of those, everything has a frequency. You know, our orbit around the sun has a frequency. The moon's orbit around the Earth has a frequency.
Okay.
So it's like the harmony of the spheres, they call it, where we're all in this harmonic kind of dance together, if you will.
Let me ask you a quick question. Let me just interject here, because I'm trying to wrap my mind around the pyramids having this frequency. It almost sounds like they're tuned, quote unquote.
Right.
And so you're saying that we're finding the same chord in a quasar, which would be in deep space. I mean, if everything has a frequency, I mean, that, sure, but do you think that this is coincidental, or do you think that this is something that the ancient Egyptians were in tune with?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because I think what we have found, or what I have learned since the publication of that book, I've been contacted by people who have been involved in the composition of music that is based on the frequencies of, say, our DNA. Susan Alexander, who is a very talented composer, worked with Dr. David Deamer, who had mapped the frequencies of DNA, and the dominant frequencies in our human DNA, you do find the F sharp and the C sharp, and, you know, some microtonal frequencies that you find in the King's Chamber.
Wow!
And so, it's really when you consider, my book is just scratching the surface when it comes to actually understanding what the ancients knew and what they were applying, the kind of science they were applying with the pyramids in Egypt. And not just the pyramids, but the temples too. I mean, it's just a huge, huge subject still open for research.
Yeah.
And you know, it's like the Giza power plant just scratched the surface on it. But at least it does contain some of the basic elements, you know, to work with in terms of understanding that, yeah, there is an acoustical phenomenon with the Great Pyramid, and it has a frequency, and that frequency matches the Earth. It's not just the it's not just what has been detected on the inside as far as the movements of sound or vibration within those spaces, but also how it relates to the Earth dimensionally, and also how it relates to other heavenly bodies dimensionally. Mm-hmm. And its location on the planet, I mean, that wasn't an accident. It's at the center of the landmass of the Earth, and then the placement of the shafts within it, and how they line up to certain features in outer space. So everything about it is it speaks of a kind of a I would say it's a an all-inclusive, you know, it matches, or it brings together and marries the everything at the Earth, from deep Earth to the surface of the Earth, to the humans living on the Earth, to outer space. I mean, the universe itself, and everything is actually brought together and quantified within the Great Pyramid. I know it sounds really far out and fantastic, and maybe even more far out and fantastic than I wrote about in the Giza Power Plant, but after all, that was written in 98. It's
sure.
2016, and people's thinking does evolve over time.
Well, I don't think that we're talking about stuff that's too far out. I mean, you've got direct connections to the precession of the Earth at Giza as well. I mean, there are so many different variables that point to this thing not being an accident, yet academia continues to label this thing as a primitive tomb that, you know, was built with limited knowledge of you know, engineering and architecture and megalithic construction. It just, it doesn't make sense, you know, it really doesn't, and it's unfortunate that there's a lot of closed minds kind of running the show there.
That, you know, that that situation is expected. I mean, that I didn't expect it to be any different.
Sure.
I didn't expect my book to be embraced by the academic community. I haven't really fought to have it accepted by them, because I knew that I would be wasting my time. So,
sure.
You know, I have to spend my time and energies doing things a little more fruitful than trying to open up closed minds.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that is, I stopped talking about the academic community and the closed-minded Egyptologists a long time ago.
Sure.
And hoping that eventually, you know, things will change. I mean, and I would say that not all Egyptologists are closed-minded. I think that some of the more famous ones have expressed a certain closed-mindedness and rigidity to new ideas. That's political forces, if you will, career security. That's another thing you have to understand, that, you know, everybody has to make a living.
Right.
And so they
the underlying motivating factor there.
they're no different than anybody else.
Right. Well, let's go back to the acoustics of the pyramid. You know, we do have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to talk about the precision of the acoustics. I've done a lot of reading online, and I want to ask you what your take on the precision of the acoustics of the Great Pyramid is. So, more from Chris Dunn right after the break. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to this week's episode of Lost Origins. If you're just tuning in, I'm your host, Andrew, and this week we are chatting with author and researcher Christopher Dunn. We are talking about all things ancient Egypt, more specifically the Great Pyramid having served as a power plant. This is one of my all-time favorite topics, and before the break, we were discussing the theory, and we were talking about the acoustics of the Great Pyramid and how it's almost tuned to a very specific note. So before the break, Chris, I had asked you a little bit about the precision of the monument, and you had mentioned, you know, you can't fit a sheet of paper in between some of the blocks. I mean, the stonework precision is one thing, but yeah, the acoustic precision is a whole nother animal. I mean, I've read that if you're standing in one chamber and somebody is in a different chamber on the other side of the pyramid, you can have a conversation with that person.
Yeah.
I mean, that is some incredible acoustic technology. I mean, tell us a little bit more about your research surrounding the acoustics of the Great Pyramid and maybe how that ties into these having served as a power plant.
Okay. When I was actually doing the research on the Giza power plant, the idea that came to me was that the King's Chamber was the power center. And I considered it to be a power center because it had it was made out of granite. They had constructed it using thousands of tons of this red quartz granite. It had 55% quartz, and it was brought like from 500 miles away down the Nile. Some of the blocks weighed up to 70 tons. But it's a very unusual chamber. And if you see a cross-section of the Great Pyramid and you look at the so-called King's Chamber, you'll see above the King's Chamber these five layers of granite beams. Very unusual granite. All different shapes and sizes on the upper side, on the top side of these beams, but regular flat and square on the sides and bottom.
Okay.
And so I was already considering that that particular space or structure was the power center for a power plant, but I hadn't really decided how it was activated. I mean, I knew that we had quartz crystal has a piezoelectric property, and it will produce electricity if it's stressed mechanically.
Okay.
Across certain axes. And so the piezoelectric effect, in order to release that within the granite, you know, I was trying to think, well, how did they actually squeeze the material in order to free the electrons in the material, in the quartz? And it seemed to me a natural thing was that whatever that energy was, it had to be able to be transmitted throughout the structure and through also the granite beams. And these were five layers reaching up above the King's Chamber, and the natural energy that would be able to do that would be sound. And so, you know, at that point it occurred to me that it had to be sound that was actually activating the entire pyramid. And well, after that, it seemed that everything seemed to fall into place, because then we start to look at some of the later research by researchers that came, such as Tom Danley, mm-hmm. and then Paul Horn, who actually recorded his flute inside the King's Chamber and other chambers within the Great Pyramid. And so then the acoustics became even more relevant in terms of its significance within the Great Pyramid, that the Great Pyramid was actually intentionally designed to maximize the movement of sound, particularly through the Grand Gallery, which is a very unusual geometric structure.
Right.
And it seems that that structure within the Great Pyramid was designed to focus sound to the King's Chamber. And there was a lot of, you know, different features within the Great Pyramid that required an answer, mm-hmm. such as the slots along the Grand Gallery wall, where you have these ramps that go up the Grand Gallery on both sides, and mm-hmm. they have these slots cut into them. There's 27 pairs of them along the length of the Grand Gallery, you know, and so what was the reason for these slots? That was a question that needed an answer. And there was a ledge coming out of the ascending passage into the juncture between the ascending passage and the Grand Gallery and the horizontal passage. And there was a ledge on the floor of the Grand Gallery that matched the ledge coming out of the ascending passage. You know, what was the reason for that? And many, many, many different anomalies and features that you may just overlook if you're, you know, as a tourist walking through and taking in the grandeur of the place. Mm-hmm. But when it comes down to inspecting the details of it, you know, you sometimes you get mired in the details and you don't see the big picture, and then other times you see the big picture and the details escape you.
Right.
But you have to take both into consideration. And so all of these features in the end, as I began to put everything together, indicated that the Great Pyramid was pulsing through the action of a pulse generator in the sub-chamber.
Uh-huh.
And so that pulse generator caused the vibration within the Great Pyramid. And then the Grand Gallery housed a series of resonators, and essentially the vibration coming through the structure was converted into airborne sound within the Grand Gallery, and then that airborne sound was directed into the King's Chamber, which caused the King's Chamber to vibrate in harmony with that sound. It was sound of a particular frequency, probably in harmony with the natural frequency of the chamber itself.
Uh-huh.
And so using sound, they were able to squeeze the quartz and release the electrons within the quartz and cause an electric field. Then what did they do with it?
Well, yeah, that's the million-dollar question, right?
So, yes, I mean, it's not a very simple thing, and as things fit together, you know, one thing explains the other, and it may not necessarily fall within the same, within, you know, the sequence of events. It may come afterwards. It's kind of like, well, we're going to be looking at what the effect did this energy field in the King's Chamber have on the atmosphere within that chamber, and what kind of atmosphere was it? And so, you know, I proposed that they were actually converting that energy into a microwave energy. And I started to do research on what kind of a gas would be suitable for microwaves to be generated.
Okay.
With. And it turns out that hydrogen would be the perfect medium to create a MASR, microwave amplification through stimulated emission radiation. So with that, you look at some more evidence, and the northern shaft coming into the King's Chamber, the dimensions of it are 8.4 by 4.8, And, you know, it has the dimensions of a suitable waveguide for a hydrogen maser. The wavelength of hydrogen is 8.309 inches. And the width of this shaft was 8.4. So, you know, with a suitable metal liner, then you could have a nice waveguide there. Then, of course, if we're fixed on the hydrogen as being the mazing medium, so to speak, then how do they create the hydrogens? And so for that, we take a trip down the Grand Gallery and along the horizontal passage to the Queen's Chamber, which I described as being a reaction chamber.
Okay.
And then we have a lot of evidence within that chamber leading to it, and also within the chamber that speaks to the chamber functioning as a reaction chamber, or that there was some kind of a chemical process going on in that chamber. And on doing research on how we could create hydrogen, one of the methods was to combine two chemicals and boil off hydrogen, zinc. Hydrated zinc being one of them, and dilute hydrochloric acid being another one, and combine the two, and then you boil off hydrogen. And I actually demonstrated that on one of the episodes for Ancient Aliens. I didn't blow up the lab, so I was happy about that.
Always a success when it doesn't end in explosion, right?
You always get the feeling with these TV people that's exactly what they want you to do, is blow up the lab, you know.
Well, I mean, drama sells, right?
Right, yeah.
So explain to us then, Christopher, the connection here to Nikola Tesla. And I mean, I feel like you're kind of foreshadowing that for us, but I know you talk about that in the book. I mean, it sounds like they're using some similar technologies, right?
Yeah, I know. I mean, I would defer to a lot of, you know, electrical engineers and people who have studied Tesla. I couldn't really speak authoritatively on what Tesla had done. I've read about his work, and I've read about his attempts to create wireless electricity through his Wardenclyffe Tower. And it seemed that, you know, that whether his methods were identical to the Great Pyramid, maybe the objective was the same in terms of broadcasting electromagnetic energy into the atmosphere, and then allowing it to be tapped into distant parts of the planet. So that is as far as we go with Tesla, except for the one other aspect of his research, where he was researching resonance, and he basically made a earthquake machine, and he said that if you knew the resonant frequency of a structure, you can design a low-powered vibrator or to actually bring that building down. And he demonstrated it by attaching his device to one of the I-beams in the building that he was I think it was his apartment building, I'm not sure, but anyway, it worked too well. And he had to shut it off before things got really bad.
Yeah, you're going to have a pissed off landlord in that scenario.
Right. And similarly, the experiment by Tom Danley in 1995, when he went into the King's Chamber, and he took a nice amp and speaker, and hit a frequency that the guys who were helping him, it freaked him out, and they had to leave because then he had to shut his system down because of the response of the chamber to those really deep bass frequencies. So, and so we know, and it does have an effect too on the human organism. You know, the very low frequencies have a profound effect on the body. Wow. They can cause disturbances in the gastrointestinal system. Hmm. So. But anyway, that's essentially Nikola Tesla. I mean, he touched on a couple of the aspects of the Great Pyramid.
Sure.
Perhaps not identical to what I was talking about in the Giza power plant, but certainly related in terms of how a building has a natural resonance.
Right.
And if you strike that building at its natural frequency, and repeatedly at its natural frequency, then it will, you can shake it apart.
Hmm.
And so that comes in when you consider the whole idea of having a coupled oscillator.
Mm-hmm.
And a coupled oscillator will vibrate as long as, if it's married or coupled to a larger vibrating body.
Mm-hmm.
And it draws energy from that large vibrating body. And so the Earth is the larger vibrating body, and the pyramids are the coupled oscillators.
Wow. It's insane, though. I mean, again, when we think of the ancients, they're often painted as, these primitive peoples, but yet here they are developing technologies and utilizing technologies that are just mind-bending.
Well, I have it on a very good account from a very respected physicist that their understanding of linear acoustics was far ahead of our understanding of it, even though, you know, we are studying it. But nonlinear acoustics is a field that is very complicated. Mm-hmm. I couldn't even begin to speak authoritatively about that. I
sure.
just know about its existence.
Sure. We've got time for one more quick question, Christopher. This
yes,
one
sir.
Comes from one of our listeners.
Yep.
Steven wrote in when we announced that you were going to be on the show. He wants to know if you think that obelisks play a part in tapping into the energy that the pyramids were creating. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's a very interesting concept in terms of let's put it this way. I think it's entirely possible. Not just the obelisk, but also other standing stones around the planet.
Mm-hmm.
We would be blind to not recognize the fact that that energy travels and frequencies, you know, that are driving into the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Could be picked up by distant objects. I mean, that's just a matter of physics. It's just going to happen. It's
right.
It's like saying that, you have one string on a piano and it's not going to have any effect on any other string on a piano if
right.
you start hammering on it.
It's going to resonate with the other strings.
Exactly.
Right.
And so the obelisk, but then the question is, what purpose do the obelisk serve? And it's not just the obelisk. The question for me is not just about the obelisk themselves, but also the temples. Because one of the things that I have noted in my travels in Egypt, and particularly in the south, where I've been through the temples, and I spent hours inside the temples, and is that they are built, I'm convinced, they are built with an acoustic design to them, and they are a part of the system. But the purpose that they serve is not it's a more of a subtle technological function in the way that we as humans are affected by our environment, not just the quality of the air, but the quality of the sound that we are surrounded by. And so acoustics is huge in terms of how humans interact within an acoustic environment. And I think the obelisks and the temples played a part in that, in that they did provide an acoustic atmosphere for the and it may have been so subtle and outside the range of human hearing that their population didn't really feel it or you know, consciously, but it was affecting them on another level entirely.
Sure.
So I would say that Stephen's question is very, I hate to use a pun, but I can't resist, but it's a very pointed question.
I see what you did there. Well, what's next for Christopher Dunn? I mean, are you working on another book? Are you going to be speaking at any conferences coming up in the future? Do you have a website that people can connect with you online? What's next?
Well, I have a conference coming up in June in Nantes in France.
Oh, very cool.
That's going to be near Karnak, and the conference is it's put on by Howard Crowhurst in France, and it's I'm looking forward to that. And to meet with some of my colleagues in France. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're going to visit Karnak and Gevresnes. That's the island of Gevresnes. But that's a place that is fascinating to me. They have a lot of these megalithic standing stones.
Yeah, the Karnak stones.
Yeah, the Karnak. So the conference is called From Karnak to Karnak, and it should be a very interesting conference there. Then in October, I'm speaking at CPAC, which is the conference on precession and ancient knowledge.
Very good.
Out in Palm Springs in California. And that's going to be the weekend, the end of September, 1st of August, 1st of October, rather. I'm still continuing to research, and I'm engaged in another book, which I was thinking I was going to write about Puma Punku and Coral Castle, but it seemed like I had to come back to my first love, which was the Great Pyramid. And I've had so many people over the years who have asked me when I'm going to write another book, and you know, I always respond, my usual response is, well, I'll write a book if I have something else to say that would fill the pages. I'm not just going to write a book just to write a book, right?
Sure.
So I think I have something else to say, and a lot of other people have something to say too, who are in the wings and help, and waiting to help me, and God bless them for that.
Very good. Well, keep us posted on that. I know that our listeners are going to be very eager to get their hands on that when that comes out, and we'd love to bring you back on the show and talk about those new theories in great detail. But Chris, thank you so much for joining us today. I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. I mean, yours is a brain that I've been wanting to pick for a long time, so it's definitely an honor to chat with you, and I know our listeners found today's conversation as fascinating as I did. So thank you so much, Chris.
Well, thank you, Andrew. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Very good. The pleasure is all ours.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this week's episode of Lost Origins. I hope that you enjoyed the conversation as much as we did. Today was a blast. The theories are just groundbreaking, and his brain is one, like I said, that I've been wanting to pick for a long time. So check out his work online, pick up one of his books, you will not be disappointed. And make sure that you guys tune in next week. Next week we're going to be talking with Joseph White. Joseph is a very interesting fella. He is a satellite imagery expert, and he was one of the experts that discovered the pyramids of Antarctica. So we're going to be digging into that into great detail next week. And until then, I'm your host, Andrew, and I want you to continue to question everything.